If your passion lies in elite British road racing and you want an inside line on the teams, riders, organisers and sponsors that make this sport such a compelling spectacle, you're in the right place. I'm Timothy John, and joining me for every episode is my co-host, the Managing Director of Brother UK, Bill Jones.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here. We're going to use this platform to talk about all the key issues surrounding the sport. With special guests, deep dives into hot topics and plenty of chat, we'll keep you informed about all things UK racing. Stay tuned.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Brother UK Cycling Podcast, where today our guest might be described as a living, breathing definition of resilience. As such, Harrison Wood is a defining example of the qualities inspired by the Rainer Foundation, a charity funding young British riders to race abroad, and Harrison's principal backer until the moment in the September just passed when he finally signed a professional contract. After 4 years of racing in France with highs, lows and inevitable crashes, including one this year that his memory has erased, the 22-year-old from Torquay has landed a 2-year deal with Cofidis. In January, he'll roll out for the first time in the colours of his new employer at the Tour Down Under, and it's a measure of the management's confidence that Harrison will debut for his team in a World Tour race. Confident, competitive and with a 4-year apprenticeship served overseas, Harrison is a rider whose time has finally come. Harrison, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Well, this is our second go at it. We first met before the Rainer Foundation dinner in November, and sadly the equipment let us down. But how was the Rainer Foundation dinner for you? I saw you up on the stage there with other graduates from the class of 2022.
Yeah, it was nice, actually. It was good. It's nice to meet everybody again, you know, because you probably only see 4 or 5 of them throughout the year, I think, about races. And then to see everyone there and all the riders who are supported by the fund, it's nice. And to see also, you know, the fundraising that's going on and the guys who are willing to put their hand in their pocket for items, which in turn help out a lot of us, you know, racing. So it's nice to see when Tom Pidcock's jersey got sold for a good price and like the Ineos camp. It's nice because it means, for me watching it, I think, oh, there's other guys now who are going to get funding like me. Yeah, it's just a nice evening and always a good laugh, which is good.
Did you get an early night or did you hit the town?
No, not too early. Probably got back in, I don't know, 5 a.m. I think I did. And then I left, I think, at 8 o'clock the next day, so I think I got about 2.5 hours of sleep. But it was all worth it, you know.
So more of an early morning then than an early night.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, more of an, I should have just carried on and just made it a full, you know, 24-hour stint.
Well, fair enough. I mean, the pro cyclist holiday is short, isn't it? It's November, basically, and then you're back to it. What have you been up to since the dinner?
Yeah, sort of like started getting back into training. Not anything too crazy, but I was doing sort of quite a lot of off the bike work this winter. I've sort of been, since my crash, sort of noticed that I've sort of lost quite a bit of upper body stability and balance sort of things. So I've been trying to rebuild that and then just sort of gradually getting back into training. Nothing too hard yet because next year's going to be a long season. The team have sort of got a lot of races planned for me over like all different types of terrains and stuff. So I think they want to try and keep me a bit fresher. And especially starting straight away at Tour Down Under, you need to be on a good level, but also not already at 100% because you've got to maintain that else from January all the way to pretty much October. So yeah, it's like a fine balancing act, I think.
I wanted to start, Harrison, with a bit of an abstract question, really. I wanted to talk about resilience. I mean, we said in that intro there that you did a full 4 years as an under 23 overseas, beginning at the age of 18. Did you know that you had some kind of inner strength before you embarked on this adventure, or is resilience something that you've developed over that period?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I sort of knew I had like an inner strength or resilience. It's something you sort of find out, and I've sort of found that in my first year away from home and stuff. There was times that I missed home a lot when I was in France, but there were also times when I didn't like sort of think about being away from home. It was sort of like a bit normal almost, and I think that was it. It sort of just became almost normal for me to be away from home, and then when I was home it almost felt strange then. And I think, yeah, just sort of like I stuck at it, really lucky with my support from my parents and my whole family, you know. Like I still speak to my mum and dad when I'm away most days, well every day actually. I speak to them every day at least probably once or twice a day. And I think that's one nice thing, is just having like that family there, which makes it a bit more normal, makes you feel a bit more like you are home and that you have got people around you to talk. Because the worst thing is if you're away from home in France and you've got no one to talk to or anything like that. And it can be quite a daunting experience. But I was sort of quite lucky that I had a lot of guys around me also within the team. Like I had Alex Braybrook when I was first there, and he was really good at helping me with race tactics and at races. He'd sort of like, you know, I'd room with him, and it was nice just to have a bit of a British feel as well. So I think, yeah, it's just something I found within myself that I had that resilience and that I could sort of just, in the end, I quite enjoyed it. So it was, and it just became normal.
Well, you certainly tested yourself physically as well as mentally and emotionally. I mean, the resilience that you need to get over crashes and that kind of stuff. How important is resilience to a pro cyclist of all people? Your first sporting love was football. I mean, is it harder to bounce back from setbacks on the bike than it is on the pitch?
I think so, definitely. Like, you know, when, especially when I think like about the crash I had in June, it was really bad. Some things like that, they would knock people down and people wouldn't be able to recover from them. Whereas with me, it was sort of like I could just sort of saw it as a minor hiccup almost. And yeah, like it was more of a, like a long-term vision for how I'd get back and sort of almost pretty much looking already to like this year, coming 2023, you know, as what I could do to be there on a good level. Yeah, you've just got to be really resilient. And like with crashing as well, it's sort of just part of the sport. It's not like it's going to happen at some point. You're going to have probably a bad crash at some point in your career. You're not going to get really lucky. I know some of the older guys like Ad DS in France said he never crashed in a race before. And I was I don't know if that would happen now. I don't think there's a pro cyclist now who can say he hasn't had a crash yet. It's part of it, and you just got to not learn to love it, but you just got to learn to accept it and think that everybody at some point is going to have a setback, and yours has just come at that point, and it's how you get up and how you bounce back, really.
Is it that ability to bounce back, do you think? You know, whether it be from physical injury or homesickness, is that the defining quality of a Rainer rider? You know, would you have gained that same level of inner strength if you'd gone through the academy and spent 3 years living in a house in Manchester?
I wouldn't want to take anything away from the guys that do academy, because, you know, they're also away from home quite a lot. But I think it's completely different when you're in a foreign country, you know. It doesn't separate the Rainer riders, but it definitely makes a difference to anybody in the UK who's racing, because, you know, you have to go away from home for months where you don't see your family or whatever. And it's a big difference between staying in the UK. And I think it's quite admirable how people my age and younger than me as well want to go away and sort of like change the whole life in a way just to try and pursue the dream. And then once it pays off, you see, like for me, the last 4 years, I think, wow, it's paid off, you know. It's sort of like all fitted into place, and obviously that's super nice. And then sadly there's other guys who do the same as me, and it doesn't pay off, and that's then also, it's hard, but at the same time you've gained life lessons and life experiences that you wouldn't if you had just, say, ridden for the academy, basically. So I think that's makes it sort of quite special and unique, really.
Well, the Rainer Foundation trustees are very clear, aren't they? They say, look, we're not seeking to create pro cyclists. It's great when we do, and my goodness, you know, they've helped nearly 85 riders turn professional in the last 20-odd years, so they certainly know what they're doing, but they're always very keen to stress that it's about giving young people life-changing experiences, and you've clearly had those. I wanted to throw a line at you, Harrison, from Tim Harris, who, of course, is a former British road race champion. He's a DS at Team EF Education, Tipco SVB, the Women's World Tour squad, and, of course, Tim does an awful lot for the Rainer Foundation. When I spoke to him after the dinner, he said, yeah, Harrison did the full 4 years overseas as an under 23. And I think that might give him a platform for a long career in the World Tour. He mentioned Dan McClay, who's about to start his 9th season as a professional, and who also spent a number of years with the foundation. I mean, does that give you confidence? You've slogged it out for 4 years. You could now be looking at a long career in the World Tour.
Hopefully, yeah, that was definitely the aim. Once you're there, you want to stay there, you know, you want to get better and stuff like that. And I think, yeah, like you said, having slogged it out for 4 years and seen the not so nice part of cycling, as in hotels and stuff like that, it's now you're going to see the nice part of it in that sort of respect, but you're also going to see the hard part of it in terms of the racing. So I think it's definitely given me like a platform and almost like it's like training talk. It's almost like giving me a base of cycling stuff. So now I've just got to try and build on it and go from there. But I think, yeah, it's good to know that people like Tim, I've got a lot of respect for Tim and spoke to him at the Rainer dinner and stuff like that. So it's nice to know that he sort of thinks that it would give me a good stepping stone, basically. So that's a nice for the confidence, that's for sure. So fingers crossed.
Well, let's go right back to the beginning, Harrison. I mentioned there in passing that your first sporting love was football, and that's a fairly unusual transition, isn't it, from the pitch to the saddle, so to speak. How did it come about?
When I was younger, I was football mad. I sort of knew about cycling, maybe watched the odds race with dad or whatever, because dad sort of like liked it, you know, sort of like the Armstrong era it would have been, with like George Hincapie and people like that. Guys that I sort of watched on telly, I wouldn't have known many others. Contador and that. Yeah, it was all football for me at the time when I was younger. And then when I got to, it was 11 or 12 years old, the team that I was playing for, because I played for Torquay United's like development team, like their academy. So at the time they were in League One and League Two. A good team, you know, it was serious. I think we trained twice a week and had a game on a Sunday. Every time I finished school, I'd be playing a bit outside in the garden, you know, that kind of thing, really sort of focused on that and nothing else really. And then they got relegated to the Blue Square Premier at the time, which was a fifth division in English football, and the money basically went for the academy, so they scrapped the academy. And I was sort of already at that point maybe falling out of love with the sport. I was sort of thinking about getting a bit tiring, and obviously at the age of 12, it's a long way to go if you get a bit tired of football, because it's not such a long career then. And so yeah, I just sort of like stopped. I played a bit with school still, because I could still play, and the manager at the school team, you know, always sort of the best footballer in the school, so it was always quite nice to just play with them and stuff. But I sort of then was, yeah, not really playing much. And I'd say probably around like 14-15, I think it was, when I sort of like started cycling more, and then like doing coaching. I didn't really do much racing up until probably the age of 17, just because of exams like GCSEs and stuff like that. I wanted to focus on them. And then yeah, from there, obviously then sort of like 17, did like did a full year of racing with the juniors, you know, like Junior Tour of Wales and stuff like that, and then moved straight to Aix from there. So was quite lucky with, obviously, with HMT as well. Raced with HMT with Mark and Tony, which was good. Yeah, just sort of like transitioned from there up, and then sort of basically went full-time into cycling. So it was sort of like quite a bit random in a way, but it sort of happened because sort of just riding a bit. I used to help my dad at his beach business, renting kayaks and then stand-up paddleboards and jet skis and that in the southwest down here in Torquay. And I used to just ride to work and back, and I sort of found myself getting faster and faster and challenging myself more and more. And that was then when I sort of thought, oh, well, I quite like cycling. Actually, I'm gonna stick at it and see what happens.
And that willingness to challenge yourself, I guess, is another manifestation of a competitive spirit. I know that you are a competitive character. How closely is that sort of inner drive related to physical expression? I mean, we've got Christmas coming up. Are you someone who has to win at Monopoly as well, for example? Or is it, you know, the chance to express yourself in athletic terms that draws you to sport?
Yeah, I think like athletic terms, I'm very competitive. I would say I'm a bit competitive with like a bit of a quiz or something like that, but not really. I remember at school, I never really used to be competitive with trying to get, you know, the highest grade in the class. It was always a bit more of like a funny thing. If you beat the guy who'd done 11 hours of revision and you'd only done 30 minutes, that kind of thing, you know, it was more like a humorous competitiveness. Whereas with athletics, I'd say obviously like any athletic sport, I sort of find myself being a bit competitive, unless I'm super bad, and then I sort of don't really care. As soon as I find something I'm all right at, I sort of become quite competitive. I think that's what every sportsman is, competitive. Even if they say they're not, they are. It's like a trait that we all have, especially cyclists. You know, it's a team sport, but there's still competitiveness. You know, even if your job, for example, is to do the lead out, you still want to be the best lead out. You don't want to be, you know, you're competing with other people, and that's what pushes the level up as well. You know, yeah, competitiveness is, but everybody's got a bit inside them.
Well, football and cycling offer very different modes of physical expression, don't they? Football is explosive. You've got to be first to the ball, quick over the first 10 yards, all of those terrible cliches that we associate with explosivity in the players. The cycling, very different. Its defining characteristic is endurance and riders taking suffering to an art form, you know, that ability to keep going at whatever cost. And my goodness, you've done that. So as a footballer turned cyclist, you're pretty well placed to identify any unifying characteristics between the sport. Is there an underlying spirit? Is it that need to compete that might unite a footballer and a cyclist?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's true for sure. I think for me anyway, I also find that, like training, I find that inner competitiveness with yourself, you know, you always want to be better than the last time you did a session. So if you have the exact same session, you know, efforts or whatever, you always want to be try and push yourself and be slightly higher power, or have the same power but with a slightly lower heart rate, which might show that you're going slightly better or slightly quicker on the loop or whatever. You know, you're always trying to be a bit competitive. You know, you always want to try and hit maybe like 20 mile an hour on that loop or something, or certain time on that segment. So it's always like inner competitiveness, whereas football's maybe a bit more like, in training you're not as competitive because you're just doing it as hard as you can, sort of thing. It's like you're maybe a bit competitive with your teammate, but obviously on a football pitch you're 100% competitive with the other team, and you know, you're with the 11 players and you're not competitive really with them because you're trying to help them and that sort of thing, but you're with the other 11 players, it's, you know, it's a war basically. It's that sort of like mentality in a way, whereas cycling's a tiny bit different. It's more like yourself intrinsically, you're being competitive in training, and obviously then in a race it's again a bit like a war field because you're trying to fight against the other guys. Like we saw at the Tour this year with Pogacar and Vingegaard, it was like the competitiveness and the war out there, you know, they were just chasing each other down and launching attacks with 150k to go, whatever it was.
Oh, an unbelievable race. Another factor uniting cycling and football is the team dynamic. I mean, you've literally just come back from your first training camp with Cofidis in Denia. How was the team vibe? Did you feel part of it from the get-go?
Yeah, definitely. It was really like everybody made me feel really welcome. And I think within Cofidis, there isn't a Jonas Vingegaard. Everybody knows that. But there's still Guillaume, Benjamin, Thomas, Jan, Izagirre. There's a lot of really high level pros, you know, won Tour de France stages. Geschke, who was in Polkadots, nearly won it. They made me feel really welcome. They were talking to me on rides and that sort of thing. And it makes you feel really, you know, united. Like this year, I was at outdoors watching the Tour de France and you watch these guys going past you. You're like, that's amazing. But then I was then at dinner with them, you know, and you're out on a ride with them. It's quite strange. You almost have to pinch yourself and think like, wow. And imagine that's the same for like, you know, like everybody, like Sam Watson, Oscar Olly, you know, all of us have watched the telly, watched racing, and then you sort of then sat at dinner with them. It's a bit of a strange experience, that's for sure. But it's definitely a really nice family experience within the team, and everybody's really welcoming. And obviously there was the World Cup on at the time and the French beat the English, so I was cheering anybody that France played. I think I was a Morocco fan one night and then became an Argentina fan the next. I was actually hoping that the French were going to win because I'm more of a Ronaldo man than a Messi man. So I was hoping France might win. But now Messi sort of settled that debate now that he's the GOAT. So that's a bit of a shame. But yeah, it was then it was quite funny, you know, cheering when Morocco scored or whatever, you know, or it was good fun.
That England-France game, that must have been a lonely night. I think you are the only English rider on the team, aren't you?
Yeah, luckily we travelled the next day, so I didn't have to put up with it. But they came out with all their old Harry Kane's penalties only just arrived in France. You know, it got identified as a plane and all that rubbish. And I'm like, all I kept saying was, oh, the referee was the worst ref I've ever seen, and kept asking them how much they'd paid him. That's all I could come up with back. But they weren't too bad, to be fair. I think they knew that the French weren't very good against the English, so they didn't bully me too much. So that was quite all right.
Well, we began by talking about resilience, and I guess another expression of that quality within the context of your career is this very patient rise. You know, 2 years with Aix-en-Provence, split around 2 years with SEG. I don't think there was any one defining moment, any career-defining performance. It's very much been a gradual progression, which I guess in itself shows character. You know, would that be a fair assessment of your career to date?
I'd say so, yeah. I would say, like, especially like junior, there wasn't anything defining us for sure. I mean, and obviously, yeah, under 23 as well, it was more like a progression, you know, like first year in France, I didn't really do anything crazy. I came up there in some Spanish big sort of races, like second in Volta Castello, which is quite a big Spanish stage race, but nothing like crazy. I'd say this year was maybe like more of a breakthrough in terms of the results. I won one of the biggest stages of a French stage race, like second in one of the biggest Spanish stage races, won a stage in pretty much the biggest Spanish stage race. And obviously up there in Course La Paix until my crash and stuff like that. I think it's sort of been more of a breakthrough year this year. And that's, I guess, from like you say, resilience has sort of paid off basically. And it's finally all clicked into place. And obviously I know now guys are making results as a junior and going straight into pros, or first year under 23. And straight into pros. So that's also two different aspects, there's two different dynamics as to how you actually turn pro almost now. I think it's nice for me anyway to see it's finally paid off. And I've had quite a few of the other guys on the day, Reign of Fun, saying, you know, who are coming into their fourth year now, like Ollie Knight and Charlie Page and stuff. And it's like, you know, you're only really like one or two results away from turning pro. That's what I've sort of think, and I think that's what most people would agree, is if you're 1, 2, 3 big results you can get and you're suddenly going pro. So it's all got to just click into place and you got a bit of luck in a way probably.
Was there anything specific this year that pushed you on to the next level, or was it more of a culmination, you know, all the years of hard graft finally paying off?
Yeah, I'd say it's all like, like you say, a combination, I think. Combination of everything, all my training, racing experiences, you know, off the bike experiences, everything sort of just all filtered into one. And I'd say it's all maybe a better person, you know, without being too cliche. It's almost like everything sort of slotted in and suddenly I've found myself, you know, knowing what I need to do to be in a good level, and I sort of found myself knowing I need to do that to be this sort of shape, and I need to do this to be in that position, and I need to look at that to really be good, you know. And yeah, everything sort of like finally slotted into place, and it's all this year, it's all suddenly just, yeah, fitted in, and I've completed the jigsaw puzzle basically, and it suddenly all makes sense.
Well, cycling has that famous phrase, doesn't it? Some days you're the hammer, some days you're the nail.
Yeah, I spent many being a nail, I reckon.
You mentioned HMT a moment ago, which from the outside looked like a professional team, except that the riders were juniors. What was your experience there? How did the opportunity come about?
Yeah, it was, like, to begin with, it was quite strange, actually. I was away in Mallorca with my mum. I was training a bit for cycling, and we just went on a bit of a cycling holiday, basically. And she'd hired a bike from Tolos, I think it is, maybe, bike hire. It's the one in Palencia, I've forgotten the name of it now. She had a problem with it, so we went there, and Mark Barry was there, and I'd watched a few of their YouTube videos, so I knew of him. So I thought, I'll just go and introduce myself and see what happens. So I went and said hello and had a bit of a chat. We went and had lunch and stuff like that. He's having lunch there, so we had lunch with him. And I'd had a bit of a chat about racing, and he invited me on their training rides for the next 2 days, and went out with them and did a test with them as well. And I was, yeah, I think not the best, but I was one of the top riders in the team on the test that we did. So that was quite good. And then he invited me basically to do Junior Tour of the Basque Country with them. For me, I'd only raced locally in the UK at that point. I'd done the Primavera road race, which some people might know. I'd won that, so that was all right. But I'd only done, I think, 3 road races. And then I was going straight into Junior Tour of the Basque Country. I think I'd only done 1 junior national up till then. And straight there, I was like, wow, yeah. But it was amazing. We had 6 or 7 helpers with us, assistants, with Tony and Mark, obviously, and Craig, the mechanic, who was there, who I still speak to a bit nowadays as well. And it was crazy, really. You know, we were doing turbo warm downs after each stage, and massages, everything was taken care of. It was like a pro team, really. And I think it's such a shame now that it doesn't happen, that there isn't the team, because it was just crazy how good it was, you know. And I think there's quite a few juniors who would really benefit from it, and I think there's quite a lot of under 23s and pros, like James Shaw also rode for them. I think they would probably say that they wouldn't be in their situation if it wasn't for Mark Barry and Tony Barrett, really. I think I'm probably one of them as well, you know. Had those experiences in Europe, I might not have ridden them for Aix. I might have tried and ride for Canyon or Ribble or something, and I probably wouldn't be in the situation I am now. So it all happens for a reason, I guess. But Mark and Tony are definitely, I'd say, the unsung heroes of British junior cycling. Yeah, it's a shame they probably don't get the recognition they maybe deserve, because obviously now the team doesn't really exist, so nobody really knows about it. But just got to ask the guys that have ridden for them. There was obviously a lot of us at the Dave Rayner dinner, and you know, you realize how lucky you are that you had everything supported for you. You know, as soon as you left the house, everything was covered, you know, train tickets, flights, bikes, everything. Yeah, it was amazing.
Well, that is a heck of a tribute. I mean, specifically zooming in on this aspect of European racing, I've got a quote from our aborted recording from before the Rayner Foundation dinner. You made a really interesting point. You told me everyone in Europe knows how to race. You got 180 guys on the start line who know how to handle their bikes, who know how to push and shove. And that really sort of caught my imagination. I wondered where that extra level of performance, racecraft, you know, call it what you want, I wonder where that came from. Is the structure just better in Europe? I mean, if you were to compare the French Division 1, for example, with the National Road Series, is it just a more professional product? Or are we talking about a cultural thing? You know, British success at cycling's highest level is a comparatively new development, isn't it? So what do you think? Is it structural or is it cultural?
A bit of both, probably. Obviously, like, in Europe, cycling is massive. Like, Holland, Spain, France, it's huge. You know, the races they get, junior races, the whole village are out watching it almost. Whereas in UK, you're probably getting the whole village are out, but they're complaining about it. They're parking their tractors on the road, aren't they? That kind of thing, normally. Whereas in Europe, it's a bit more like everybody's out watching it and they want to get involved, you know, and stuff like that. And I think also then, yeah, from, like, the sporting side of it, is that most DM1 teams and most riders in Europe are paid, not amazing salary, but an all right salary, which means they don't have to work as much. So they maybe do 1 or 2 days a week working, and then the rest they're training. So then they're doing same as pros, they're doing 21, 22 hours a week on the bike. Whereas in the UK, there isn't, I don't know personally how the structure works, because I've never really spoken to anybody in the UK. But so I don't know if teams are paying a lot or whatever, but quite a lot of the guys I know are working 4 or 5 days a week. So they are working full time. And then they may be training 12, 13 hours a week. It's a big difference. And, you know, if they have to then travel by themselves all around the country, you know, you've got a national up in Scotland, you've got to drive to Scotland to do it. Whereas in France, if there's a national up in Normandy, you travel as a team, you know. your team take care of it. You maybe fly, you meet them there and that sort of thing. I think it's a massive difference in that, you know, everybody's then suddenly racing, maybe be 70 race days a year, I think. Like even with my crash, I think I had 70 odd race days a year this year and I was out for 2 months without racing. Whereas in the UK, I think you'd be lucky to get 70 days of racing within about 3 years at the moment. It's a shame because I think there's a lot of really good riders in the UK. Alex Richardson, Jack Rootkin Gray, they did the Tour of Britain and then they go over to Belgium and they're ripping up crits in Belgium with the pros, you know, and they're racing for St. Piran over in Belgium. But yeah, in the UK, there's, I think, 4 National Series races next year, are there?
British Cycling are promising 5.
Well, you think there's 8 Coupe de France's in the DN1 system, but that's like the top, top level. And then I think there's probably like 100 elite nationals, which are basically the same as the National Series races in the UK. So there's probably, I dread to think how many more races there are in Europe compared to England. One thing again comes back to the Dave Rayner Fund. If the Dave Rayner Fund wasn't there, then Brits would just not be able to go abroad and race. And there'd be so many talents that are lost. I'm not going to suddenly come out slating British cycling because they do so much for the sport as well. You know, with the track, it's just a completely different system and different culture really in Europe, if I'm honest.
Well, as you say, it's a shame that so many British riders are being forced to race in a system where the structure could be so improved and where the best events, you know, the Lincoln Grand Prix, Cycle Classic, for my money, they match any in cycling. And presumably those are races that you'd love to compete in.
Yeah, like I think with Aix, they rode the RAS 1 year. Obviously, it's Irish, I know, but didn't even discuss an English race or anything like that, you know, because normally Aix, they would try and do maybe a bit of a foreign race for being cool and that sort of image, you know, but they didn't even discuss, you know, a Lincoln Grand Prix or a Rydale or whatever. And I think it's just, yeah, it's like, it's a shame, really. Because if they did come over and do them, it would be amazing, like how good a Lincoln Grand Prix would be if there was maybe 5 or 6 French teams, a couple of Belgians, and it'd be amazing. But it's just without it, it's just guys who are working full time, drove up the night before, got to the hotel at midnight, racing at 9 a.m. the next day, and then going back and working the next day. Yeah, completely different culture, really.
Absolutely. But we had a window on that, didn't we, with the 2021 National Championships, I think, which were epic. I mean, that gave us a glimpse of just how good that race would be with a world-class field. I mean, Ben Swift, Ethan Hayter, Fred Wright, Harry Tanfield. What a race. You know, Lincoln is a brilliant race with a domestic field, with a world-class field. Obviously, it would be another level again.
Yeah, exactly. It was on YouTube, you know, you could watch it and stuff like that. And on GCN as well, wasn't it? I think there is the basis for it to be an amazing race. You know, if you've got like 4 or 5 French teams come over, and if they still had it then televised, it'd be huge. And obviously Rutland Cycle Classics, so a UCI race, that's quite cool because it means they get some more European teams. But I think there aren't that many European teams that do it at the same time. That's the problem. There's like probably like 4 or 5 UCI races in Europe at the same day. That's the thing, you know. And it's hard then for teams to pay for the tunnel, come over, pay for a hotel and race. They'd have to do all going back for 4 or 5 days or whatever, whereas they can just drive maybe 2 hours and they're doing the same UCI level race. It's a bit like that, isn't it?
So how did you make your connection with the team in the first place, Harrison? How did you turn up on their radar? How did they turn up on yours?
So when I was second year junior, I sort of always wanted to go to Europe. I thought, if I want to be a pro, I'm going to have to go to Europe. And I sort of was looking at teams and I was sort of trying to figure out teams that might be a bit easy. And my dad's got an apartment in Alpe d'Huez in the French Alps, and Aix is around 3 hours from there. So he said, oh, that one would be all right, because maybe you could even live in the Alps and drive to a race or whatever, because I wasn't really sure at the time of what races were what. And so I just sent them an email and I got an email back straight away saying, are you free for a chat kind of thing? And I spoke to who at the time? Jeremy Panettiere, who was called, who was like the media man, because Jean-Michel didn't speak a word of English and I didn't speak much French. It would have been obviously an awkward conversation. And then he spoke English, so we spoke about everything. At the end, he just went, yeah, no problem for us. And I was like, oh, okay. Do I need to sign anything? No, it's fine. Just get yourself over here in January, basically, and off you go. I was like, oh, brilliant. You know, and then sorted out all my accommodation and that was it, basically. So it was just from picking out a few teams for my dad that might be easy, you know, and trying to look at French teams, and found the email address online, and that was that, and just pinged off an email and hoped for the best, basically. And that's exactly what I did.
Well, you're making it sound very easy. I'm quite sure it would have taken a big logistical effort as well as fortitude, you know, that inner strength we were talking about earlier. I mean, how old were you for a start? 18, 19?
Yeah, 17, I think I did all my emails, and then I turned 18 and then had my 19th birthday when I was away racing in France then, basically, as a first year. So yeah, it would have been 17 and 18 writing the emails. Obviously quite young making that decision, but just what I had to do, I guess, really.
Had you lived away from home before?
No, never. I've been away skiing for about a week. I've literally only ever been probably on holiday with my parents, and I think I maybe did like one school trip for about 3 days, and that was the most I've been ever away from my parents.
Yeah, a lot of people would say that's a bold decision. You sort of glossed over finding your accommodation. Was that a challenge? I mean, did you have any advantage from the fact that your dad has a place in France, admittedly some distance away, but I guess you would have had some idea of how the French rental market works, for example.
It was, to be honest, quite easy. The team helped me quite a lot, actually found me a place. That was that, basically. I sort of just then sort of had to just pay for it each month, and that was it. And then I live with Ollie Knight. We live in a host family type thing, which Alex Braybrook sort of found for me when I was with Aches. And then I've sort of then did, obviously, my 2 years with Seg, and then went back to Aches, and that was where I was staying, and that was where Ollie's also been staying whilst he's been at Aches. So it wasn't too hard to find accommodation for me, which was quite nice.
What sort of town is Aches? Is it a nice place to live?
Yeah, really nice, actually. I think it's sort of known for being one of the nicest places in France. So I can't really complain about living in France. Like, I'm sure a lot of guys at the Raider Foundation could tell you about bad accommodation and bad towns, but I'm spoiled when it comes to that. I can't say a thing.
And the host family, are we back to culture there? Are they cycling fans? Are they people who wanted to welcome cyclists into their home? Or is it holiday accommodation and you could have been anybody?
The family are part of the Aches Club, so they do follow cycling and they do like their cycling. And obviously it's really good because it helps me to improve my French as well, you know.
Well, tell us about your first night in Aches. I mean, were you sat there feeling homesick, thinking, what have I done? Or did it feel like the start of a great adventure?
For the first couple of months, it was a bit of a strange experience. I was a bit like, mum and dad had sort of taught me how to cook, you know, different meals. And I got a lot of meal things and that, and a couple of cookbooks. But I didn't really know how to not entertain myself, but to keep myself occupied. And so I sort of found myself, it was a bit strange. So that was why I sort of spoke to my parents quite a lot during that period. But yeah, it was almost like when it happened, it was, oh, this is an adventure now. You know, that's also quite a nice feeling to know that you're about to embark on your own adventure and do your own thing. That's quite cool.
How was your French at that point?
I wouldn't say bad, but I learned some at school, but school French is not French. If that's my one tip from the podcast, is don't learn school French, whatever you do. It doesn't help you at all if you know what a chair and a pen is, really. conversational French is a lot harder, and it's taken some learning. I'm getting there still. I'm still learning new bits. But I am now able to have a conversation and I understand most things. That helps.
Well, this might sound like a ridiculous question, but is that critical to immersing yourself in the culture? Or were people in the team in the village, you know, quite tolerant? Or is the young British cyclist, his French isn't great, but he seems like a nice guy? Was it that kind of thing? Or did you only really start to feel part of the scene, part of the team, when your French improved?
Yeah, I think so. Once you sort of French improved, then it sort of feels like you become part of the team. I think there's quite a few French guys that speak English, but I don't think there's that many French people that speak English, especially down where I was at Aches. You know, it was quite a French team. So then it was a case of having to learn French in order to fit in. You can't really expect French people to speak English just to allow you to be formed in. It's like you have to make the effort. And that's what I sort of did, and found myself slowly getting in and more involved with the team and able to have more and more conversations. And I think that's probably the most important thing, is to learn the language, basically. Obviously, if you're racing in Belgium, I don't think anybody expects you to learn Flemish, because not even Flemish people speak Flemish, I don't think. It's that hard.
How long did it take for Aches to feel like home, until you could return after a race and think, great, home again?
Yeah, probably a couple of months, I'd say. It's sort of just a couple of months of getting used to it and finding my feet and that sort of thing. And then I'd say it was pretty good. You know, I was quite happy by then.
Is Aches convenient for racing, or did you have to travel long miles to get to events?
Yeah, it's a long travel with Aches. I think that's the only thing, because it's down in the south. There's a few races, but they're normally, like, we would travel to Spain, which was like 6-7 hours. We didn't really go to northern France, but like then more like towards Lyon, and that's like another four or five hours in the north, and to Italy another 5-6 hours. So it was always quite a lot of traveling and quite a lot of driving, but always you came home to pretty good weather and a good climate for training. So that was also, can't really complain.
Good training roads too?
Really good. Yeah, really nice. Everything was, yeah, it's nice there. I really like it. Maybe not big mountains, but good weather and pretty good roads and normally pretty quiet as well. So it's nice.
Will that remain your base this year, Harrison, now that you're with Cofidis, or will you move to a different region?
No, that's sort of what I'm planning to do, stay there, and just so it's not such a big change, there's nothing too crazy, nothing too new for me, so I can just focus on my racing basically and learning as much from the racing as possible without having to worry about if my boiler turns off in Girona, I have to call or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. You know, it's already a big change, so I don't really want any extras added onto it, to be honest.
I can picture you in the peloton worried about the boiler.
Yeah, exactly. It's the last year's troubles, isn't it? But, you know, oh, now I've got to get home because somebody's broken in or whatever, you know, that kind of thing.
Halfway up Alpe d'Huez, you know, thinking, gosh, what about the boiler?
Yeah, exactly. It wouldn't be good.
Now, another team that played a big part in getting you to where you are today is SEG, S-E-G, which is a Dutch continental team, or was, I should say. Tell us about that experience. How did that come about? How did you join SEG after a year with Aix?
Yeah, I sort of just was with Aix and obviously like was going well, but I sort of thought like, oh, maybe I can try and do something a bit different and improve another, try and get another level higher. And so I sent off an email and sort of basically got replied back and they said, oh, no, seems, yeah. So I sort of kept in contact with them. And then I had a call with Bart Van Haren at the time. He was like the team manager. And he sort of said like, no, we're really impressed with you and everything like that, you know, and we'd like to offer you a place. And I was like, oh, wow, I didn't really expect it. SEG was sort of always trying to look for talents that other teams maybe hadn't. So they were like, were quite keen with a guy that hadn't maybe raced loads of different races, but had done quite well in races that he had done. So I joined them and yeah, it was 2 years. It was amazing, to be honest. It was a big step up and everything. Again, it was fully organized. It was like a pro team. You know, we did the biggest races, Baby Giro, everything like that. I learned so much there in terms of how to be more pro on the bike and off the bike, the recon, looking at races before and all that sort of stuff that goes with that. And I think it was just a big opportunity and I sort of embraced it and I tried to do everything. I think if like you ask any of the staff there, I was sort of always trying to be quite proactive with what I was trying to do. I wasn't really taking anything for granted. And yeah, I think that helped. Those experiences helped me a lot this year and obviously hopefully will help me moving forward with my pro career, basically.
That's impressive that you've been so proactive. I mean, moving to France would have been a huge step for a teenager. You'd only been there a year, but you were already looking to take your career onto the next level. Where does that restless ambition come from? Are we back to confidence and competitiveness? Or were you aware, even at that age, just how short a professional cyclist career can be? Did you have that sense that, you know, the clock is ticking and you've got to get on with it?
Yeah, I'd say so. Definitely, like, yeah, you've sort of just got to get on with it. And I think quite lucky with having not pushy parents, but two parents who really supported me with everything I did, you know. And, you know, mum and dad, they were always wanted the best for me and would do anything to make sure I had the best situation, you know. And so it was almost like when I said about it, they were both like, yeah, go for it. You know, like, what do you need to do? Oh, have you done this? Have you done that? And that kind of thing. And I think that was one thing that I'm forever grateful is the support of my family for it all, you know, and everything like that. And I think now it's just a case of trying to pay them back in terms of being a pro now, you know, hopefully they can watch it and think, oh yeah, finally it's all come good.
Did that involve another move? Did you leave Aix to join SEG or could you stay in the region?
Yeah, so I moved then, came back home. Obviously, we had COVID year, which everything was written off then pretty much. And then last year with the team, we lived in Holland. There was like 4 or 5 of us from the team. We lived in like a house with all the UK and foreign-based riders. So that was quite nice. But again, it was by that point, I'd been living away from home already for a whole year and by myself. And this point, I was with other guys. So it was a nice, nice experience. And yeah, good times.
And how different is life in the Netherlands to life in Provence?
A bit wetter. bit damper, bit colder as well. It was quite similar, you know, you just sort of, with cycling, it's not like you're going out every night and going to a nightclub, you know, you're sort of in bed by 10, 10:30 most nights, eating pasta or whatever for dinner. You live quite a simple life. You live a bit like a monk, I'd say, in a way. Wherever you are, it's always pretty similar, I think, if you ask most guys. Can't imagine there's many cyclists that do anything abnormal or special. So I found that quite nice.
What was the team's mission? I mean, SEG was the big name on the jersey. What was their commercial model?
Because SCG is like an agency, cycling agency. They've got the most amount of riders in the World Tour in terms of agents. So I think their sort of like idea was to develop the riders, turn them pro, and then they would be their agents when they're pro, you know, that kind of thing. Sort of that's how it worked, I think, pretty much.
Well, they must have been very incentivized to get you a contract. Did you come close to turning pro from SCG? Or in a wider sense, did you need to go back to Aix to finish your apprenticeship, so to speak?
Yeah, I think I sort of had to go back to Aix, really. I had all right results, but nothing that would, I'd say, make me go pro. I could maybe have, like, pro Conti if I was lucky, but I doubt that also. So it was, yeah, it was a case of just having to go back to Aix and do a full race calendar with Aix in the hope of turning pro from there, basically.
Well, one thing that's cropped up a lot in my recent conversations with Rainer riders, Sam and Oscar, for example, they've turned pro now, but, you know, neither was in any particular hurry to do so. They were like you. They were very proactive in pursuing opportunities, but they weren't part of this very latest generation. You know, I'm a good junior, so I need to turn pro in the next 6 months, you know, what you might call the Remco effect. As Sam said specifically that he didn't want to scrape a contract. He wanted to be a good under 23 before he even thought about turning pro. Did you have a similar mindset?
I think so, yeah. Like, also for me, there wasn't like opportunities. It was probably a bit different for Oscar and Sam. Is like they probably had the maybe already a few teams sort of knocking on their door maybe before that, whereas I didn't really have any contact with any big teams as such. So it was a case for me of just having to slowly plod away and hope for the best, basically.
And how did it feel to go back to Aix? Did it feel like coming home, or did it feel a bit like Snakes and Ladders that you were back to square one and had to start again?
No, it sort of felt quite good. I felt like I came back with a lot of more experience and I knew what I had to do in order to be on a good level in France. So actually, in a way, it was quite nice, I'd say, definitely.
Aix-en-Provence, of course, has made a connection with Cofidis. That relationship, I think, has been critical in this latest phase of your career. Is that a formal relationship? Is Aix-en-Provence a recognised feeder for Cofidis? Or is it, you know, a little more casual than that? Have relationships within French cycling helped to create this opportunity?
Yeah, I think like Aix is sort of becoming a bit more of like a feedery type team for Cofidis. But yeah, I was lucky to be sort of part of that, you know, doing a bit of a training camp with them and then being the stagiaire, which sort of all came about from the connection with Aix and Cofidis working together. That's how it sort of developed from there. And yeah, very lucky to be in that situation where they've sort of tied up with a World Tour team. So yeah, very good.
In which areas are you trying to impress, Harrison? Is it all about what you do on the bike, or is it also about how you conduct yourself in the hotel or on the bus or during the team meeting? Is it a 360-degree assessment where they consider every aspect of your suitability as a team member?
Definitely, it's everything, I think. You know, you've got to be, firstly, obviously a good bike rider helps massively. That's probably the 90%, but then the other percent of them are what you like as a person, what you like with the team, what you like with the staff as well. I think is a huge thing. Is not to be, you know, he's a soigneur, but he's also still a person. You know, you've got to show respect to everyone, you know, because without them you're not doing your job as well. And that was one thing they kept saying about was how polite I was and how kind I was to the staff. And it's like, I think that's again down to my parents with my upbringing. Always say thank you, always say please, that kind of rubbish, you know, that kind of cliche sort of comment. It's true, it is like a whole thing. They want to look at you as a package, you know. You're not just a bike rider, you're a person, and it's how you conduct yourself, you know, because you could be the best cyclist in the world, but if you're going out every night getting drunk till 1 a.m. they don't like that, I don't know.
Well, we've talked extensively about you spending the full 4 years as an under 23 overseas. When you finally got that opportunity with Cofidis, did that add pressure? Did you feel like, you know, this is the final chance? Or was it the reverse? Did you think, I'm fully prepared now after racing in France and the Netherlands, and I've learned how to conduct myself as a professional cyclist?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I sort of saw it as then, like, not like I was born for this moment, but you sort of feel a bit like it was, yeah, like everything's now, it's now your chance, you know, you just got to go out there and do it, basically, and get the pro contract. And that's what it comes down to, you know, you've done all these years of hard work and now you just got to finish it. You just got to tap the ball in the hole in golf term, you know, in a Happy Gilmore sense, you know, you just got to put the ball in the hole, happy, that kind of thing.
Did you feel that you'd done enough when you finished the stagiaire races? Did you think, I couldn't have done any more?
I think so, yeah. Sort of like each race I was getting better in terms of my level as well. So that was good for them to see that I was nowhere near my peak. And then I was just getting better and better and better and improving and improving. It was good for them. I was happy as well, so it was good.
And how long did they make you wait before confirming the contract?
Yeah, luckily it was only 4 or 5 days after Tour of Luxembourg, which was quite good. I think mid-September, I think I sort of knew, or beginning of September. So it wasn't too long to wait, which was quite nice.
Well, that must have been a huge weight off your mind. Have you discussed goals and ambitions and the type of role that you might play, or is it still much too early?
I think like this first year is going to be more about just learning and without pressure. You know, I don't have any pressure to win a race, but if I can do well, it's up to me to do well. You know, it's all on me. They haven't said like, oh, you need to do well at this race. You have to do well at this race, and it'll be get to a race and there won't be as such pressure because I'm new, I'm a Neo Pro, but there'll be an element of expectation, I'd say, but nothing too crazy and nothing too detailed either, which is nice, which is sort of a good situation to be in as a Neo Pro.
Just finally, Harrison, a word for the Rainer Foundation. In a sense, they've created this opportunity with Cofidis by providing 4 years of funding. Clearly, you've maximised that opportunity through your own efforts too, but it really is something, isn't it? This class of 2022, seeing you guys up on the stage, 30 riders and 5 of them turning professional. I mean, that really is an achievement.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's pretty crazy. It's improved every year. There's more riders every year. You know, I think when I was there, it was maybe 20 when I first started. Now there's, I think, over 40, is there maybe, or something like that. It's crazy how many there are now. And I think, you know, testament to the whole fund. If I'm honest, I didn't realise how many people were behind the fund until I was at the Dave Rainer dinner. You know, I didn't realise how many that were on the board of committee, you know, who helped and put their ideas forward and helped to keep the fund moving forward with the times. You know, it's now a registered charity as well, you know, and everything like that. It's just amazing to see that the legacy hopefully will live on, and hopefully the Dave Rainer Fund will keep getting stronger and stronger, and they'll keep getting more British riders turning pro, basically, which is just, yeah, again, a testament to Jocelyn, Ryan, really, and Keith Lambert, who do so much for us as riders over in Europe. And I think every rider in Europe on the Rainer Fund, as I think, have a lot of thanking to do.
Well, Harrison, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. When do you board the flight for Australia and the Tour Down Under?
Just the beginning of January, the 6th or the 7th of January, I think it is. I'm going to Nice next week for a bit of a training camp before it, to try and get a good bit of sun, a bit warmer weather in, and then go basically straight to Australia from there and, yeah, start racing. So, yeah, can't wait.
Well, I'm sure all of our listeners will be tuning in to watch the Tour Down Under in January. Harrison, thank you very much again for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, please hit subscribe.